So I
Yeah.
got a quick question for you though.
Okay.
Not in a kind of a weird way, but do you think Clark's taken Martha flying? Surely.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, surely he
At
has,
some
right?
point, he,
He has to,
yeah.
right? Like, you think she wrote a poem?
Know what's funny is my mom writes poems for me. Pretty much every birthday, I get a poem from my mom.
Oh, that's
That's
so sweet, though.
a fun fact, fun Josh fact. But
There you
if
go.
Martha's anything like
Thank
my
you.
mom, I'm sure there have been
She had a poem ready.
plenty
Yeah.
flying poems in his history.
I mean, talk about being proud of your kids, though.
Yeah.
It's like the bumper sticker, my kid's an honor student at ABC Elementary, and you're like, yeah, well, my kid's Superman. He won all the honors.
Up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Josh, Dan, and
Superman.
Welcome, everybody. It's Josh, Dan, and Superman. Dan, how
Sir,
you doing?
great. How are you?
I'm good, man.
We have returned,
We have
as you might
returned.
say, as you might say.
It's funny you mentioned that because this episode we're going to be reviewing Superman Returns.
Well, and it makes a lot of sense since, in very many ways, you are my spiritual sequel, as this film
Oh.
is a spiritual sequel to two really great films ahead of it, you know?
Well, you're not my sequel, Dan. You're my original.
Oh, womp womp. Yeah, buddy. I mean, not only do we love Superman, but we love some Josh and we love some Dan on this show.
That is very
So it's
true.
basically, this could just be called Love In, but I think that name was taken anyway.
Yeah, I think it is too. We're going to stick with Josh and Superman. So I literally just finished this film.
Yeah, like, me too.
Literally just finished it.
It's fresh.
Yeah, it's fresh in my mind. I liked it. What were your initial thoughts?
Man, I have enjoyed this movie since the beginning, since it was in, coming to be a thing. I just remember being super hyped for it. I went and saw it opening day. Trish and I went to the theater for, I believe, a matinee. It wasn't I don't believe it was a big showing. But I was so excited, and I had quite a few emotional moments then. For all of the right, all of the reasons that anyone who would love this movie because of its connection to the Reeve entity, I think would have that feeling too. But yeah, I big spot in my heart for this film, because this film's got a big heart. It's a love letter to our generation. It's a love letter from a fan to the fans of the Donner Superman films.
It absolutely is.
That's its greatest strength and its biggest weakness. Just like Superman, his big heart is his only weakness,
Yeah. I think Bryan Singer did a pretty good job all around. The runtime it's a little long.
It is. But it's not really indulgent, but man, the pacing, even from is 2006, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. And even, even then, quote, relatively modern filmmaking techniques, the pacing is still, I think, and it may, now that I'm thinking about it out loud, it may be somewhat intentional to match the pacing of the first two because of the way those were made. But like, Superman, the movie is just about as long, but doesn't feel it,
it doesn't
because of
feel
the
it.
way it's structured. Even the changes that were made to kind of make it work into what became the sequel of it, it still paces better narratively. The pacing in this is just extended for the sake of trying to match that, I think.
Yeah. I think, the first movie, Superman the movie, 1978. Yeah. I think one of the reasons it doesn't feel quite as long is the whole intro. Mm-hmm. We talked about last episode where we don't actually see Clark as Superman until about an hour into the movie. But that's right. Because the whole intro, you know, the whole origin story takes place. To me, it kind of it's kind of separate from the main story of the film. Mm-hmm. So when you get to Clark in Metropolis, it kind of feels like it jumps
resets the clock. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That's a word we like to use. We reset the clock. People forget they're sitting in a chair or that they've been waiting. It makes it feel and it's a natural narrative break, right? I don't feel like there are very many of those in this movie because we're already with established the characters, timeline, universe.
Right off the bat, too, Singer kind of lets us know that we're in the same universe because mm-hmm. we have the John Williams score. Yep. And
the visuals, bro, the titles
look almost exactly the same. And we have Marlon Brando's voiceover at the beginning of the film. Yep. So it kind of lets everybody know, like, hey, we're still in the same universe, you know? Mm-hmm. The only thing that's different about the credits, do you know what's different about them?
I wouldn't be able to say, but what's different about them? You educate me, friend.
The difference is in 1978, the blue letters would come up for the name and it would go off into the distance.
Yeah.
In this movie, they come up and they go towards the audience.
Because they've returned.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
See, it's just a little tidbit.
Well, you know, Josh, having been a storyteller and a means of storytelling yourself, you know these things aren't by accident, right? Someone's paying attention to that detail. And your mind, subconsciously or not, picks up on it and puts you in a place to accept that story. Like, subtle things like that don't happen by accident, but it's nice to know that someone somewhere, whether or not it was actually their job or not, got paid to make sure that detail was tended, and it pays off.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that the titles are kind of returning, mm-hmm. because if you'll notice in the background too, we are returning to Earth. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, you see Krypton blow up and you see the pieces of Krypton, but the whole time, the whole title sequence, we're returning to Earth until we finally get there at the end.
Well, and it mimics the as original arrival to Earth very much. So for those who kind of fill in the gap here, there's a Reading Sucks, by the way. If you have to put up a Read Me card, it's you need to find a better asking your audience to read in a movie unless it's subtitled is it's a shortcut that gets taken way too often. That's not a slight against Bryan Singer, but there's a better way. What it establishes, though, is that, you know, hey, after the end of these events, Superman went some soul searching and left for 5 years. So he's been off Earth, searching the remnants of Krypton for piece of his history or whatever. And he is literally returning from that trip to Earth. And no one knows, even Lois, no one knows why he left or where he went and or what the story is. The world just assumes he's gone.
Lois doesn't like it too much, though. She takes it personally.
Well,
she moves
should.
On. She finds another man.
Cyclops. She moves on to Cyclops.
Yeah. She's got a thing for superheroes.
Well, you know, apparently James Marsden isn't known for making great career choices. Not that this was a bad role for him, but in the context of filmmaking and film history, y'all, he left the role of Cyclops in X3 to come play the role of essentially Lois's cuck. Sorry, can we say that on this
podcast? I don't know.
I'm sorry, y'all. But you know, she's moved on, and the appearance is Richard. His name is Richard. The appearance is that Richard and Lois have a son, and he believes, well, he allows himself to believe that this is his child and everything is normal. But yeah, Lois was like, nah, man, see ya. You know?
Yeah. It must have been pretty quick too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, because 5 years isn't a long time. I mean, it's longer than we really want it to be. But, I get the sense because the youngster is older than five, right? I mean, he's got to be. Or they were playing a you know, a 10-year-old is a 5-year-old. So it sounds as though he was around for some time, after the events of Superman 2, and then left on a soul-searching mission. So there's, I don't think it's only been 5 years in the amount of storytelling. It's just that he's coming back after having been gone for 5 years.
Yeah, I was just, you know, I was just going to say, if Cyclops thinks that, and I will be referring to him as Cyclops for the
entire podcast. He's always Cyclops. Yeah.
I can't. if Cyclops actually believes that it's his son, like the old switcheroo had to happen pretty quick with Lois, you know?
Well, that's true. That's true. You're right. And so maybe that kid just is older than he just looks older than he is. But yeah, 5 years, not a lot of time. Especially considering this film is 20 odd years from its ostensible predecessor. Superman 2 is 1982 or 1980?
It's 80. Yeah,
1980. And so, yeah, that would have been 26 years between the two. And so that's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time. In this universe, we got cell phones, the internet, and all kinds of fun stuff in just 5 years.
Right.
And just like, and, we fast forward it real quick.
That stuff doesn't bother me. Anachronisms and you know, we just have to be, there's a reason it's called willing suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
We have to be, we as audience, you know, and I think this is where a lot of people who come across as dissatisfied with what they want to enjoy, they don't willingly suspend their disbelief. They don't accept the tools that the storytellers have given us to take the journey with them. Now, that doesn't mean that the tools are always good, but the rules really only matter in such that is it internally consistent, right? Do the things always happen the same way with whatever it is that we're dealing with? And, you know, as long as the storyteller has framed the context well enough, the rest of it, you just accept it and move on. Does it, because whether or not all of a sudden now we have cell phones has zero impact on telling the story, right?
There's it really doesn't. About
that. Yeah. And so you just let that be. It's like, why does the Enterprise and Discovery look new? Well, because it would be stupid for it to look like old.
Yeah.
Just come on, y'all.
Speaking of returning to Earth, we see Superman for the first time in this film. He goes back to the Kent farm via does he even have a little ship? I think he just kind of lands like a super crater.
We don't see it. I imagine there's one there. And the reason that it's what caught my eye is we see Martha at the table and obviously the building's starting to shake, and you can kind of see on her face, she's reminded of his initial arrival, right?
Yeah.
She kind of gets that same feeling, and it's very, very good choice to have him, you know, return to the farm.
Do you think there was a little part of Martha that was like, God damn it, if this is another kid, I'm getting too old for this shit. This better be Clark.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. No, it better be Clark for a whole lot of reasons. Because so Martha's like probably one of the greatest moms, because she really doesn't dress him down for not telling mom where he went when he left.
Yeah, well, when you have a super being as your child or your adopted child, I think you kind of just have to accept that every now and then he's going to fly off into space and you might not hear from him for a while.
That may be coming with the territory.
I
don't even think, though, as a parent, that you could, knowing your child is nigh invulnerable, you'd still worry about him.
Yeah, for sure.
Because they're not emotionally nigh invulnerable. They still feel, they still have the feelings. You know, Superman's a hardy.
When he lands, I noticed he was wearing a gray suit with a gray and black Superman emblem. Do you think that was a call to the black suit in the comics?
You know, like I mentioned earlier, in this movie with Bryan Singer, knowing what we know about him as a Superman fan, that was an intentional choice.
Yeah, I believe so too.
Because, you know, there's a portion of this world, there's a portion of this universe that believes Superman to have been dead, I'm sure. That's why he's gone, he's dead. Something happened, he died.
Yeah.
And it's, so let's talk about that though. The reason, you know, the very reason you're asking that question is the reason that that works in a way that some more forced measures don't, because that's, I won't say it's fan service, but it is, because if you know the lore, that's a payoff. If you don't know the lore, looks like a spacesuit.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And we'll talk about this movie at some point on this podcast, Zack Snyder's Justice League. You know, we got to see the black suit there, spoiler alert. And it was a essentially fashion choice by Superman more than it was, you know, and in the comics after the death of Superman, that black suit served a practical purpose to draw more solar radiation so that he could heal faster.
Yeah,
it's cool part of the story, and you know, we can headcanon that into Justice League, but we don't have to worry about any of that with this, because it's, you know, because it's a spacesuit.
Yeah.
And it looks like a spacesuit, you know, it's just like a cat suit. Plus, you know, man, Brandon Routh, he fills that out pretty good.
Yeah. But I think it, you know, it works either way, as a callback to the black suit, or just that, you know, that's his little spacesuit. And I like that he doesn't go, oh, hey, this is my gray, you know, Superman spacesuit.
Like my new Diggs, like, mom.
It just kind of leaves it open for interpretation. I think it's cool. So then we get introduced to, well, not introduced, I guess, we get reintroduced to Lex Luthor. The new Lex Luthor,
same as the old Lex Luthor.
Yeah, he's up to his old hijinks. He's out of jail, and the first time we see him in this
real estate scheme.
Yeah, the first time we see him in this film, he's got to get some money first. So
he's in love. What do you mean? Yeah. He's in love. He loves this. He's in love with this lady.
Something tells me he doesn't love her. Something tells me he doesn't love her.
Is it that he lets the dog eat her after she dies?
Yeah, isn't that brutal?
Oh, my God. She doesn't even care. And he's like, he finishes their signature with her dead hand, and then he just lets the dog eat her. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
Lex. It's really good, Lex Luthor. But, you know, this universe has two Lexes played by two, or a one Lex played by two actors, and only one of those actors is actually slimy in the real world, too.
Yeah, we won't talk about that. We'll just talk about
we're separating the art from the artist here.
Exactly. Well,
I mean, hey, we could that's not this podcast.
And he's got a new girlfriend. He's got Kitty, played by
Parker Posey.
Yeah, she is fun. She's a lot of fun. More tolerable. Okay, not gonna say that. I crushed Miss Tessmacher, so I'm going, you know, she's more well represented than Miss Tessmacher was. But the character of Miss Tessmacher was very good for what that character had to do, and the actor played them very well. But here, different take on that, on Lex's, you know, sidecar, essentially. Not a sidekick, and not necessarily, she stands her own in a lot of ways. But yeah, she comes to a realization that ultimately Lex is the only one who's not a pawn in his own game.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is expendable to Lex Luthor. Everyone is expendable to Lex Luthor, but Lex Luthor.
He really needs to work on finding better henchwomen, because they always seem to foil his plan.
Well, Josh, you and I have lived long enough to know that you do not... You know, you do not betray the woman. You will pay. You will pay.
Yeah, that's very true.
You will pay one way or the other. But I love the way she's played. There is one line that stood out to me that really kind of it just didn't feel like a Superman line. It didn't feel like, you know, a wholesome line. And it comes later when Superman saves her because the brakes on the car don't work, and we get the recreation of the classic $3.25 million cover of Action Comics number one. What a great every time they recreate that moment in any instance of Superman, like when they did it for Superman and Lois, when they did it for this, I'm just like,
yeah, it's
and
great.
Again, it's another one of those things that if you know the moment, it really pays off. If you don't, it still looks cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, Yeah, she has some words for Lex after that, but Lois says, well, he was off saving that hooker.
Yeah.
And that really, that grated me, because one, you know, you don't know that she's, yeah, you know, and be sex positive, Lois, come on, you know, sex workers are people too. Well, and you know, that's not to say Dan Decker hasn't ever used the word hooker disparagingly, but he doesn't anymore. And so, you know, we try to learn and we grow. And unfortunately, the movie can't learn and grow. It's locked in time.
We have to update our vocabulary every right. now and then.
But there are writers who wouldn't have included that choice in the first place. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. So Lex's plan is mm-hmm. to go back to the Fortress of Solitude and yep. steal some stuff from Superman. He takes all the crystals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he's learned. I don't know. Is it discovered how he learns the crystal technology? Because what he's doing,
I don't think they actually mentioned it in the film, because I was a little confused about what was going on at first.
Well, Lex has spent time in the fortress off screen in previous films, and being that he's, you know, Lex is not, I wouldn't say Lex is Superman's equal on the ability to attain intelligence. Superman's just got a bigger capacity. He's got a bigger hard drive, right? Yeah. He's going to be able to hold and access more information and correlate more data faster than a human. But Lex is presented to be one of, if not the most intelligent humans, you know, Batman level intellect, as far as cunning and tactical and just, and so, if anyone could figure out Krypton OS 4.0, it's going to be Lex Luthor.
It's going to be Lex. Yeah.
And so somehow he's learned about how, you know, and we watched this happen when Supes built the fortress. He just chunked a chunk of crystal into the water and, you know.
It grew.
And I think in, you know, there's backstory, or maybe this was just me filling in blanks, but with the idea that those crystals can be programmed to do what you want them to when they're activated. But he has a nefarious plan.
Yeah, he does. It's even worse than the original film. He's not just getting rid of the West Coast. He wants to get rid of all of the coasts.
Yep, you know? All of them. So the landmass that he's going to make is going to offset a good bit of water, and that's going to flood the coastlines, I think is the plan, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then he would basically, you know, own all the new land. It would be like the United States of Lex or something. At this point, Clark gets back to Metropolis and goes back to his old job.
Which is a great moment when he comes in, by the way. It's it's not the first time we see Brandon. Because he has moments at home with Martha being Clark there, but Clark at home on the farm is the character. That's the root.
At his core.
And then there's that is not the same Clark that works at the Daily Planet. Clark at the Planet is informed by his humble roots, but Clark on the farm, Clark at home is less bumbling, less fumbling. You know, Clark at work is intentionally clumsy to, you know, further the image and distance from, you know, Superman being all capable. And then of course he's Superman. And so, you know, he's had his welcome home moment. He's comfortable. He's been with mom, and then he comes into his old job, and it's a replay of the first time we met Clark in 1978, you know. He's mm-hmm. got the same all shucks, you know, and, you know, fumbling his glasses, and he's carrying stuff, and, you know, there he is. He just shows back up.
And I think Brandon does a really good job of playing the character as Chris Reeve did.
Yep.
He really pays homage to Chris very, very well in this
mm-hmm.
film.
Mm-hmm. And to his credit as an actor, because he's good on his own. You know, it's very similar to Carl Urban's McCoy in the JJ films. You know, it is a reinterpretation of something you know and love to the point that it is in essence that thing you know and love. I mean, he plays Clark to the T that Chris did, and it's, you know, there's a lot of intentionality in that. You know, that some folks would say, well, he's just imitating or mimicking, and well, that is still acting, and it takes a different level to do it without being an imitator and being an honorific, right? There's a difference to homage and mimicking.
I absolutely think that. I don't think he was really, you know, I could see where some people would say he was mimicking him, but I think he played the character, you know, he gave the character life on his own. Mm-hmm. And just, like I said, kind of paid homage to Chris Reeve, you know, with the little fumbling and the glasses and stuff like that. But I mean, he breathed his own life into the character. I think he did a great job.
I think playing Superman requires an element of Clark Kent in the actor that plays Superman. Like some part of you has to be Clark Kent, even as just a regular human being, before you can be the actor who plays Superman. And Brandon has that.
I think, and I don't know if you're going to agree with me on this one, but I kind of like his Clark better than his Superman.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, because Superman's the easy part of it, you know? I'm not saying that he didn't put effort into it, but yeah, he's not as Aw Shucks Boy Scout version of Superman that Chris was. He's much a more understated. Yeah. And that, you know, that may be, I mean, he just came back from confirming that his planet did blow up and everybody is dead. So, you know, he may have a different perspective on things as a result. But he's not jaded or, you know, off-putting. He's not like the weird Superman in the cell phone video of the Whedon cut, you know, where he just
want to talk about that.
Yeah, that's not the vibe that he, you know, he's not that off-putting as, and he's not, you know, evil Superman 3. But you know, it's not the same. I'd say this would be like the soft focus version, whereas Chris's is the sharp focus version. Right. Yeah, same thing, like, but that. Just a little bit. You got to squint a little bit, right?
I really like the casting of Jimmy Olsen. I don't know the actor's name. I know him as Mitsubishi from the that Tim Allen movie, Jungle to Jungle. But I really like him as
Jimmy Olsen, and again, someone who I think actually, you know, I'll just call it out right now. The only extended character where they maybe missed the mark with drawing the thread was Perry White. They're two completely different takes on that character, I think, between
it really is.
This Perry White is much more serious.
Much more serious. Yeah.
Which loses something.
Yeah, it does lose a little bit. He kind of seems like a dad that you'd be afraid of, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, you know, the dad that comes home from work and is always mad, smoking cigarettes, drinking whiskey.
Right, rather than the slightly manic uncle who taught you what the word fuck means, you know.
Yeah, there
that's
you
kind
go.
Of the Perry White from the. You know, he's just a little scattered. This Perry's got his shit too much together to be the same Perry White.
Yeah. and then I believe that's the part in the film where we meet the little boy, Jason.
Yeah, Jason is at the office with mom and Richard doesn't work at the planet too, does he?
No, I don't think he works.
Yeah,
he's just there a lot. I don't think he has much. Kind of weird.
Who hangs out in the newspaper? I guess if that's where your wife works.
Maybe he does work there, because now that I'm thinking about it, he is there pretty much all through the film.
Yeah. Well, so we meet Jason, and I don't know how long or if at all they expected us to believe that wasn't Clark's kid ever.
Yeah.
but they don't paint it with a subtle brush.
No, they do not.
And that makes me, I mean, I don't like that choice at all. I think we would have all made that connection without you continuing to, and because while there are elements in the story that are telling us as the audience that that's the case, at the same time, Clark is taking that journey without us when we could have gone on that journey with him.
Yep.
And all learned the truth organically. But you know, I knew right away. It's like,
it's gotta be
worst kept secret, right?
It's interesting that in the novelization of the film, mm-hmm. It is not his son. They never
confirmed.
Yeah. It's never confirmed. He doesn't push the piano on the instrument at the end.
Yeah.
None of that happens. I don't know if like DC or, you know, WB had a problem with it or something, you know, because it's not even close to canon in the comic books. I'm not sure how I feel about it. I don't know if I like that Superman wouldn't have been there for the first 5 years of his son's life. Something about it just kind of rubs me the wrong way.
Let's put all of the pieces in place that have to allow for this to be the case. First of all, the act of copulation, right?
Yeah.
Which in some interpretations requires special care. Not being crude, y'all, but they have to go to like Krypton sometimes so that he's not Superman. That had to happen. And then you would have to believe that they're just like, you have to believe that there's no way Anakin knew they were twins. You have to believe that Superman does not know that Lois is pregnant.
Yeah.
Because again, super smell, things change.
Yeah.
You've got to know. We have to accept all of this. Then he's going to be like, nah, I'm out, B. And he's not telling her he's leaving.
Hit it and quit it, man. That's not Superman.
That's not Clark Kent. That's not how this works. Especially as much, you know, in the previous films, as part of this story, he was incredibly delicate and careful with that relationship.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what kind of makes me wonder if DC and Warner Brothers didn't really like the choice of the film. And that's why in the novelization, and there's a comic book version of it, and neither one has that storyline. It is Cyclops' son, you know?
Yeah, it works either way, honestly. You just have to answer a lot of questions needlessly to get to him being Clark's son. One thing that I do like, though, is the fact that Jason has asthma, which is a red herring to throw you off that, you know, Superman's kid's not going to have asthma. Surprise, surprise. Let's flash up to Man of Steel when Zod arrives and has trouble breathing on Earth as a full grown adult Kryptonian, because it's not quite the same atmosphere. So,
hey, that's a good little catch. I like that.
Yeah. So I don't think it's the first time it's been noted that, you know, Clark had difficulty even early, but he acclimated quickly. But this, you know, this child being a hybrid would, who knows what difficulties would come from that. And, it's going to, he obviously has a little bit of strength, we find out, but kids in movies are often just there. Right. Jason serves no narrative purpose. Really.
He really doesn't.
He's there to provide tension that Richard is also there to provide. Yeah, it's just cumbersome needlessly, honestly.
And I'm skipping forward in the film a little bit, but I always I kind of think it's weird that Lois takes the kid with her to the yacht.
Yeah.
And there's even the scene before that, she's late picking him up from school because she's, trying to figure out the plot. And it's just, I don't know. I, why would you put your kid in danger like that?
Right. You would not take, neither one of us would take our children with us. You're not taking your kid to a new job site with, rebar and concrete and still getting poured everywhere. And, you know, just be like, all right, kid, I'm going to be over here framing up. You just don't fall into things that'll hurt you. Parents in movies just make stupid decisions. And that's, unless the story is about the kids or again, Jason isn't there. He doesn't bring new stakes. That whole bit on the yacht for us in this movie, it seems, is just to prove that he does have the super strength by pushing the piano across the room, which is kind of a dumb thing to have on a yacht anyway, to be honest, but rich people do stupid stuff with money. They make different choices than I would. I'll put it that way. And I'm not hating on kids in movies, and I'm not hating on this kid or this. You know, it just, as we talk about it, it's serving no. It's not adding anything that, you know, we wouldn't miss it if it were gone. I put it that way. You know, there isn't anything, taking Jason out wouldn't change this movie at all.
Yeah, and that's really what it is. And you know, the contrast to that is what's going on right now with Superman and Lois. If they didn't have two boys in that show, there would be basically no show right now. It's about Superman and his family.
Yep.
And if they're going to have kids, that's the way they need to do it. That's the way to do it in the comic books right now. You know, they're settling down. They've got Jonathan on the TV show. They've got the twins. And like you said, in this film, he's just kind of there. You know?
Well, and you know, let's think about it too. Let's go back to Superman and Superman 2. In those movies, Clark does everything for Lois.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one and only focus. She's his reason to be Superman. The whole lesson in that is that Jor-El was wrong. You have to love one of them to love all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you'll make mistakes for that one person, but you know, he learned that lesson the hard way. But also he's Superman for Lois, not us.
Yeah.
You know, and because he wants to be the Superman that Lois believes he is, right? That's his motivation. And in this movie, he has none of that. He isn't trying to win Lois back. He has, you know, a mild interest in whether or not Jason might be his child. And he really doesn't have a grudge against Richard.
Yeah.
You know? It doesn't add to the stakes, and it's really unclear. He ends up going to save them because they're in danger.
Which he would have done anyway.
Right, but they're in danger for dumb reasons. So,
all right. So moving on, we both agree. Jason is not the best part of this film.
Take him or leave him. It's fine.
But we get the first big scene in the movie where Superman has to save the day. And we see him for the first time. There's this plot about they send the space shuttles up via airplane these days.
Yeah. Yep.
And of course, that's going to go horribly wrong and, malfunctions and that sort of thing.
The contrivance for this set piece is phenomenal. I mean, it is 100% comic book contrivance.
Yeah.
No universe where would NASA strap a space shuttle atop a airplane, although they have, not for this purpose.
Yeah.
Take that airplane up into the stratosphere, loaded with reporters.
Reporters, yeah.
With a rocket strapped to the top of it, and then to fire that rocket off. There is no real world where that's taking place. So that's the contrivance we're set up with. But anyway, this is where we get to see our boy back.
Yeah, and I'm 100% believe that the reason there's an airplane involved is so he could say the line when he catches the airplane.
That's the
mm-hmm. only reason, you know.
Yep.
Because he repeats that line.
It's the callback. Statistically speaking, flying is still the safest way to travel. You know?
And it's like, oh, he said it.
He did the thing. What I do, and you know, that's a payoff. That is an example of bad fan service, by the way, to prepare an entire narrative to get to one line. But we're having fun here.
Hey, but it works for me. I really don't have a problem with it.
Right. Again, we have to accept the tools that the storytellers have given us. And are we going to enjoy the narrative? No, it wouldn't happen in my universe, but this isn't my universe. Okay. This is Superman's universe. And in that universe, they strap space shuttles to airplanes and put reporters on them. It's fine. And because that, you know, you can do dumb stuff like that because Superman is back.
Just another little tidbit I have in my notes here. Jimmy is in a bar when all this goes down. I think he's seeing it on the TV, and the bartender originally played Jimmy in the 1940s TV show.
Oh, wow.
His name is Jack Larson. So
nice. See, I love it when they throw those tidbits in. Jimmy Olsen from the 80s being the cop that Lois brings coffee to at the Superman Memorial, you know?
Yeah.
Just fun stuff like that. What I do like about this sequence, though, is the even though it's early aughts CGI and it looks like it, we couldn't have gotten an action set piece like this in the Reeves style of effects filmmaking. We just wouldn't see something like this. The closest we got was like the Air Force One scene, and that was all done in studio. This is, and it shows that for one of the first times, especially on film, that Superman's strength has consequences, that physics still exist. Just because he's strong doesn't mean he just grabs onto the thing and it stops being in motion. His opposing force has consequence when it comes to torsion on the wing. Essentially he ends up ripping he gets both wings ripped off, but definitely one of them gets scored off. But one of my favorite things was the way he lands the plane. It shows that, his resistance is, and it's caving in the nose of the plane, and it takes him, you feel like it takes real work for him to accomplish that, and then to set it down as gentle as possible. And you see the ripple go through
the ripple fuselage
effect. But that's the first time we got to see the physicality of Superman's strength in a way that we hadn't seen before.
One thing this film does really good is show his strength. Mm-hmm. I feel, like you're saying, I feel his power throughout this whole film. And I think they do a very good job of it.
This film is, one almost ridiculous set piece to the next. And so, we have the bank robbing scene of the bank robbers with the weirdest plan ever. Get to the roof where we have a roof-mounted Vulcan cannon and a helicopter waiting for the bank robber who committed on the bottom floor in a city with someone who can fly. but it leads to some special effects. The scene draws back to a scene that's in the extended TV cut of the 1978 film, where there's essentially a gauntlet Superman goes through before he gets to Lex's lair, where he's frozen and shot at and burned. And that, I don't believe that was in the cut that you and I watched for the show. Because I don't have the TV cut, but now I'm gonna get it. It's available on Amazon Prime. It's the only place you can get it. This has a callback to that with the bulletproof expose on, and one of the things that sequence does that I think a lot more a visual that we can have in the modern era, when it shows the bullet impact his eye, mm-hmm. and you see just the thinnest gap between the bullet and his eye tissue, And that's always been like, you know, part of the lore is that he has that thin layer of radiant shielding because of how his powers work. And that's like, you see in that, you know, that like there is an aura of protection between him and the outside that, you know, that's why he's bulletproof.
Yeah. It's a very cool effect too. It works really well.
Yeah.
After all this goes down, I like the moment where Perry tells Lois that she's going to be, you know, writing the article about Superman, and he says Superman Returns, and it's like, oh, name drop.
Boom, boom. Yeah. And then I don't know where it is when she was like, she gets into, you know, the double entendres of, you know, I did Superman already or something like that. There's a whole like 12, you know, conversation for 12-year-olds about.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, she's
exactly.
Making dirty jokes.
it kind of goes along with what we were saying earlier, though, where it's a little bit out of character for Lois. I'm not sure about some of the decisions they made with the character in this film.
Right, like, you know, Margot Kidder's Lois made jokes about what a terrible speller she was, and this Lois, you know, makes not that we didn't have a good bit of, you know, sexual wordplay in 1978, but it was like one and done. Yeah, this one, you know, a couple of just missed the notes, and that's nothing against the actor. It's just the way, you know, they read their lines as written.
That's on the writers for sure.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that it's a misunderstanding of the characters. It's just a misuse of them, misuse of their tone, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think too, these days, there's so much drive to modernize whatever reason, this would have been maybe not as impacted by it, but you know, it can't be from the 40s because no one does that anymore. And you know, but no, there's no reason for her to be like that other than the writer decided that that's how Lois would be. And that's not, I don't think we agree that that's how Lois would be.
You've been practicing your 40s voice, haven't you?
Yes, of course.
Going back to things that I like about the movie, when Clark watches Lois go up the elevator, I really like showing his x-ray vision because she closes the door to the office, and then you see the door kind of slowly disappear, and then she gets into the elevator, and same thing, that effect where he's watching her go up and you're just seeing her float in the building. I thought that was really cool.
That's one of the, just in my head, I think about, how does his x-ray vision actually work? Like, can he resolve between molecules? Is this visual acuity just so strong that he can see between the space between atoms, and or can he see in the x-ray spectrum? I guess that's probably the more practical answer, is he can just see a broader EM spectrum than we can, that he can control what he exposes himself to of that.
Yeah, he can kind of switch it on and off.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
So when Lois gets up to the roof, she's not very friendly to Superman. She's kind of pissed off at him. She's kind of a bitch.
Well, you know, I mean, she's been stilted for 5 years. She moved on to not super guy. I mean, Richard's probably a good dude, but he's not Superman. I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to have to live up to that, you know? I mean, like, how super is everything about Superman? Could be pretty good.
And she's probably dealing with those feelings. Like, what are you doing back? I just got over it.
Like, I just wrote you off, bro. Why are you back? Yeah. Like, I literally wrote the paper. I wrote the article that wrote you off.
Yeah.
I won a Pulitzer for when you got here, and I won a Pulitzer for when you left.
So then, you know, Superman, he pulls his one move that he knows he can pull. He's like, well, come on, baby, let me fly around with you. So they do a little flyby. With no poem.
No? Oh, yeah. Yeah, no poem this time.
No poem this time.
Although they could have squeezed one in given the runtime.
They definitely could have. That is the thing about this movie. It drags on a little bit.
You know, I want to tell Hollywood how to do their job, but you should really, like, just get a rando fan out of the crowd and be like, okay, and I'm not talking like focus groups in the theater. I'm like, let a fan sit down with the editor and go, okay, let's fix this.
Yeah, let's take this out. Let's take this out. Let's move this along a little bit.
What you do is how it would work is you sit there with your belly buster 85-ounce soda pop from the theater, and you start drinking. You know, keep just like you would in the theater. And if the movie ain't over by the time I cannot not go pee, we got to cut some shit.
Yeah, we got to cut some shit. Yeah, you'd have to have a pretty long discussion with Zack Snyder to get him to cut his movies down, though, I think. But see, there's a difference, though, because it's not like I don't dislike long movies.
Right.
Like, this movie, to me, feels longer than Zack Snyder's Justice League, and that's kind of crazy. Yeah.
Right. Well, and that, you know, we can do an episode to contrast that, because that's actually a very cool, I think, a meaty discussion we can have about how, Justice League is 4 hours and some change, the way it was structured. And that's not to say that we ain't got some fat to trim in the Justice League, y'all. We could run everything at full speed.
Yeah, we could lose some stuff.
you know, a little less chorus. Battlestar Galactica is taking a look at you, Zach. This one, because with Justice League, while the beats weren't expected up front, once they established the parts mechanic and that we will provide you natural narrative breaks, even like I said, man, it resets the clock. You know, the 5 seconds of title card gives you an opportunity to kind of absorb what you just saw, prepare your mind for accepting new information. And, you know, they did that 6 times in a 4-hour movie. That's digestible, even if you sat through the whole thing, because you're being given mental resets and mental breaks, and then you're being told it's okay to stop paying attention for just a second.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It lets the movie breathe just a little bit.
Yeah. And you as the audience. Yeah. And as we talked about, I don't know if we were ahead of recording or not, but as we talked about with this one, it ends like 3 times. And it feels like forever. And so, you know, you could easily 20 minutes easily to cut off, you know,
From the ending. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Easily. I mean, you know, we could see Lex on the island. We could see Superman fall to Earth, and we could, you know, real quick in the hospital. And the next thing you know, you know, the nurse comes in and sees that he's gone, and that would be fine. Right. It could be literally 20 minutes could be lost. But anyway,
I do like some stuff that happens in the hospital, though. The fact that, like, trying to defib Superman basically breaks Metropolis power grid.
Yeah, that's cool.
they're like 7,000 million joules.
And I like the little bit with the needle. They, you know, they can't stick him with a needle.
They can't stick him with a needle. Yeah.
Like keep all that stuff. All that stuff's good.
Yeah.
So moving swiftly along, let's go to the yacht, man. Lois puts her child in danger and goes on this yacht, and, you know, quickly realizes it's Lex and what's the word I'm looking for? Inheritance.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
His inherited evil lair that is, you know, a little bit of an upgrade from what he had in the original film.
So, you know, one thing about this Lex Luthor in this universe, we're never really given insight into where he gets his resources, aside from this film, where he's obviously just, you know, has he always schemed against elderly heiresses with vast income resources and stolen, you know, millions of dollars from the children on the way out the door? I mean, he's obviously very good at it. So I wouldn't say this is the first time that's how he got money. So, you know, but, you know, in Superman, he's living large under Metropolis in abandoned railway stations, you know, which is a life that I would definitely indulge, especially with that swimming pool he had. But ripping off rich heiresses, I don't know, seems like an awful lot of work.
It would be a lot of work, but probably not a lot of work for him, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, no, he is so cold and calculated. It's really kind of delicious.
Yeah, he probably swooped in right as she was dying and, you know, probably didn't have to put too much effort into it.
He spent the same amount of time as Superman was gone, probably 5 years. That's a low-key investment for Lex Luthor.
Yeah, man. especially with what he got out of it. That's a nice yacht.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. I got $0 and then a yacht in 5 years. That's a really good ROI.
Yeah. I like that we see his wigs in his little changing room. It's one of the wigs is the wig he wore on the in the first movie when he was
the curly wig.
Yeah, the curly wig. Yeah.
Nice throwback. You know, and the fact that we do, though, you know, he shows his bald head through this whole film, though. He doesn't actually ever wear the wigs. They're just in there.
Yeah. Well, apparently Kevin Spacey did not have any qualms with shaving his head.
Not the same issue that Gene Hackman had. Yeah.
And Jason points it out. That's the first thing he says to Lex is, "You're bald." It's like, damn, that's rude.
That's bold. Yeah. You know.
Of course, you know, once Lex discovers that they're on the yacht, he kind of has to go through his...
Oh, he has to monologue. Yeah,
evil monologue.
Yeah, I think Lex Luthor invented the evil monologue.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a map behind him while he's monologuing, and it shows a landmass off the coast of Florida. Now, is that supposed to be where the Fortress of Solitude is? Or is that his plan where he's going to launch?
I think that's his plan where he's going to drop the crystal nugget and build Lex, and then that would cause coastal flooding in the rest of the areas. And so, because you know, I think our understanding is that the fortress is in the North Pole. That's where I've always put it in my mind. I think
that's what I always assumed too. And when I was watching it, I was like, huh. Is he trying to say the fortress is off the coast of Florida? That doesn't make any sense.
No, I think that's, or maybe he had more than one island he was going to build.
Very true.
One for the plebes.
And one for him. For himself. There you go.
Yeah, a little tropical island. That. He's not living with us. He's Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
Man, find a way to get on a space station. He will.
I think it's pretty cool that one of Lex's henchmen is Cal Penn.
Yes, he doesn't have but maybe two words, just one line through the whole thing. He's just quietly running the drones and running the camera. And
well, because everybody else looks like a henchman too, you know. There's the bald guy with the tattoos, and you know, there's the one guy that like kind of wiry, and then there's Cal Penn. Whatever.
And
Kumar,
I like that. And you know, I sad when they do the first the test crystal in the basement with the big train set, man, that kind of made me sad. That train set was cool.
It was cool.
Yeah, I like trains. Yeah.
It was a cool it was a cool way to show what it was actually going to do. I mean,
kind of a scale model throwback to some of the stuff in the original film that was done, you know, not for laughs, but has that scale model look, right?
I thought it was a pretty cool choice. When the henchman starts playing Chopsticks with Jason.
I really like that too.
I've never thought of that song as being like menacing and maniacal, but somehow it is. Like when he sits down and starts playing the accompaniment, I was like, oh, it's kind of scary. Like, oh,
see? Yeah, well, you know, because you don't want your child to become sympathetic to the bad guy.
Yeah.
But that's also why you shouldn't take your child with you to an evil yacht lair.
Yeah. You know. Also, though, he is kind of
Mrs. Lois.
Yeah. All around, I think that's kind of a theme for this episode. It's like Lois needs to make some better choices. But he's got to be one of the worst henchmen in the world because he doesn't notice that she's sending a fax.
Yeah. Wow. So there's an anachronism of the time.
Right.
Fax is how you could send an email through the telephone, kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet there are kids that watch this movie going, what is she doing? Like,
what kind of cell phone is that? Cell phones were big in the day.
Yeah. But I mean, fax machines are loud, man. You
know? They are. Like, yeah. They don't.
He didn't hear the dial tone and all that stuff. I mean, I guess he is playing the piano, so maybe that's why he didn't hear it.
But and he's a henchman, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe he's like Beethoven. He plays piano, but he can't hear, you know.
Yeah. And then there's the big reveal, of course, when he gets up to stop Lois and is kind of throwing her around and stuff, Jason throws the piano at him brutally murders him. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, so he's got that going for him.
He's got that at 5 years old, you know.
Oh, son, you just don't know how strong you were.
Yeah,
which then leads us to how many corpses are in the barn, Clark?
Oh man. But
Jonathan's like, you can never tell anyone.
Did you notice the look on the face of the henchman though? The guy that comes in after he has this really like WTF look on his face, like what has just happened?
Because hey, either way it went, either it's her or it's the kid, and you don't want bit of any of that, you know? Because you don't want to be guy number two under piano. That doesn't want
you don't want that credit
on your resume.
See, but I'm just thinking, it's like, okay, we live in this universe. Superman is the thing. This kid obviously has powers. I just I think I would say, Lex, I think we need to like do something else besides lock him in the closet. You know,
right? Yeah, he just he threw about 1,000 pounds worth of grand piano. At Bob's dead, by the way.
Bob's dead.
We're gonna need a new Bob. Oh, Doug, new Doug.
But at this point, I guess Lex leaves in the helicopter, and the shoots off. Or no, he shoots off the crystal first.
That gun was like. They put it in the breech and they close it up, but then they also put like they screwed it together.
Screwed it in, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, that's a weird gun. It's just weird design, you know. And all that thing had to be made whole cloth, right? You know, like Lex, you don't just go buy a kryptonite cylinder shooting gun, you know, off the shelf. So
maybe it was one use only. Maybe that's why they had to screw it in.
That's true. Yeah. But they have locked they've set a growth crystal, a programmable krypton crystal, inside a very large. I mean, that had to be a big old chunk of kryptonite that they drilled that casing from.
Yeah, well, I think it was just to make sure that it was going to work. I mean, he encased it in kryptonite, so Superman couldn't just, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's he made the, you know, if you're going to build new land and you're Lex Luthor, you're going to make that land out of kryptonite so Superman can't come take you away. You know, when the entire ground is poisonous.
But credit to Lex, man. It's a pretty good plan.
It is a good plan. It's, you know, as far as real estate plans go, this is the more well thought out one. He learned his lesson from the Tessmacher incident.
Yeah.
Don't leave it up to anyone but yourself, Lex.
But I mean, like I said earlier, it's the henchwoman at the end. You always get screwed by the henchwoman.
Well, listen, if you're Lex Luthor and you've done someone over, and also the other person that you're up against is Superman, and he's more attractive than you, Lex, is all I'm saying is that, you know, don't give him a reason already.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe treat your ladies better. Maybe treat your significant others, everyone, a little bit better.
I think that's the lesson here, that Lex needs to treat everyone a little better.
Did you never learn to share?
So we start to see the effects of this in Metropolis. And I think that all the special effects in the sequence are pretty cool. I like the ripple. Like when it starts, you see the ripple going all through Metropolis, and then it ends up at the Daily Planet, and you know all the windows break and everything like that. I think that's really cool. The underground fire that Superman has to put out with his cold breath, I think that's really good. Cool. Yeah, I like that he has to choose between saving Lois and saving everybody in Metropolis, and he goes for Metropolis. I mean, that's a hard choice there, you know.
It is, even still, and he makes that choice informed from his experience before too, you know, when he broke the rules to save Lois Lane. And so, you know, making that choice this time probably a little more difficult, you know.
Absolutely.
I would think. It's kind of a mirror moment from before.
shows character growth too.
Yeah, know? Absolutely.
I mean, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Yeah, is that right? Even if it's your even if it's your wife and kids.
Even if it's Lois Lane. So let's see what happens then. Oh, Lois gets a real nasty knock on the head. Did you see that part where she's trying to get out of the yacht when the yacht breaks and everything, and that metal door slams down on top of her?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, man, that looks brutal. That looks moment. Like a, yeah. It's enough to actually break someone's neck. I was like,
The people in people in movies are a little more stout than we are in real life. They survive things that like I would wimp out even if I didn't survive it, or even if I survived it, I'd be like, no.
So to me, this is where I start feeling the lag. This is where I start feeling like, okay, this is going a little too slow for me. I think that the whole third act of this film could have been the pace should have been.
It's almost like a fourth act, which is too much.
Yeah, you know? And you're actually right, because it's just like. There's the whole thing with Lex stabbing him with the kryptonite, and then there's Cyclops and Lois trying to get away, and
that fight it goes on a bit longer, but yeah, the whole he's stabbed, and then he, you know, is he gonna get up on his own, or you know, and then they dump him over the side, and then somehow we get to the hospital. It just keeps going.
Yeah, it definitely does. One thing I think is really cool. If we fast forward through all that, when Lois saves him and takes the piece of kryptonite out, he shoots up to the sky and gets a little recharge from the sun.
Yeah, before he does the sun thing. Yeah.
And then he goes back down and throws that big piece of continent or whatever into space. And then this goes back to what I was saying earlier, where I feel like they really showed his strength in this movie. Like you could tell that it was taking a lot of effort to get that big, you know, piece of landmass. Yeah. And, you know, basically, I mean, it almost killed him. You know?
Yeah. He's not unlimitedly powerful. You know, he's just incredibly strong.
There was one thing that I wrote down in my notes. Lois takes the piece of kryptonite out with a pair of needle nose pliers. I mean, that seems pretty like good thing you had just had those sitting around, right? Is that something that was in the purse? I mean, I feel like they should have given a reason why she just happened to have a pair of needle nose pliers.
You don't carry needle nose pliers in your pocket, Josh, everywhere you
go?
Well,
I do, but I'm a contractor. Like, I don't see a reason.
Literally my job, dude. Yeah.
Hey, man, I got needle nose. I got, you know, a pair of channel locks.
Some vice grips. Yeah, some channel locks.
I mean, I'm ready to go, but, you know, I'm not Lois Lane. So.
You need something moving to not move. I got you. I can wrench you down.
So I think, I mean, that's pretty much, I've hit all the points that I wanted.
Yeah, no, I mean, the ending of this movie, we've talked about it getting up to through to here just as part of it. You know, there's not really a lot to cover other than, now, when was the creepy moment where Superman hovers outside the window of Jason's room? Was that in the middle of the film or is it at the end after he's better?
I think that's in the end after he's better.
That's creepy.
Yeah, it is creepy.
You know, especially like if you know it's your son, then don't be creepy about it. If you still have questions and you want to know, ask. Otherwise, don't. I mean, that's a little weird, dude.
Well, doesn't he actually go into the room and like say some stuff to him? Doesn't he? He repeats.
Oh yeah, he repeats some of the Jor-El stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
But yeah, I agree. It's creepy.
It's not good character choices.
Yeah.
But you know, overall, aside from the foibles and the flaws that we noted but didn't focus on, it's definitely like three capes above cellophane S. So that's good.
It is. as we have noted before, that is the worst sin in Superman lore. So
you know, angry Superman from Superman 3 is two capes above cellophane S. So at least there's character growth in that moment.
Yeah.
Clark learned a lesson.
Just out of curiosity, speaking of the other Superman films, where would you rank this film in your your Superman ranking?
Oh, it is. It's the third. It really, you know, Superman II, the Donner Cut is kind of a window into what could have been, mm-hmm. But it is really good. So if I had to put it in like a quality ranking, it would be second. But as, like in my heart, it's going to be third, just because of, there's so much. I cannot be objective enough about the first two films to. Mm-hmm. You know, properly put this one into perspective, but in the trilogy of it's the third of them. But if you take all six films in this timeline, it's still number three.
Yeah,
but that's putting, and then they kind of go in the next order. It's 3, 4, and Supergirl. That's kind of how they rank as far as whether or not they're even any good.
Yeah,
and Supergirl and Superman 4 are probably tied for bottom. Not that you want to be tied for bottom.
Yeah, I think mine's the same. I think it would be third, in this universe. I think you like this film a little bit more than I do. I don't hate it, but it's definitely not my favorite.
I brought a lot. This was my nostalgia bomb, you know?
Yeah.
This movie, and, you know, there's not like there's a whole lot of difference between our ages, but this movie was made for my demographic, right?
Yeah.
Like I said in the beginning, this is a love letter from a fan in my contemporary to fans of his contemporary, right? I'm never sad to watch this movie, and one of my favorite things about it compared to, and this is just, you know, Superman's changed over time. It's like, what, 80 years old now?
Yeah.
One of the things that stands out about this movie, especially even compared to its predecessors, Superman does not throw a single punch the entire film. He hits no one. Every problem is solved with his strength against an object or through his thinking. But, you know, he even in the fight with Lex, he's not throwing punches. He's defending himself.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. He doesn't fight anybody in this film. It's all
Superman wouldn't want to
fight
because he understands his strength, and he would rather not have to use it because, you know, even at his most metered, he could still hurt someone quite seriously, even when he pulls his punches. But yeah, no, that's one of the trivia about this film that just kind of it solidifies the film's heart, right? For all of its flaws, that's one thing that will always stand out to me as, you know, a pinnacle of a Superman story. He's, you know, we won the day without having to fight.
I'm going to use that as a segue because next film we're going to be reviewing is Man of Steel.
Which is like all the punches that this movie didn't make.
I think he punches literally everybody in that film. I think he even has a fight scene with Martha. So
yeah, yeah. They slug it out in the field. It's pretty good. I didn't know Martha could fly, honestly.
So get ready for it, man. That's what we're going to do next is Man of Steel. Anybody who wants to follow along with our little, you know, review can do a watch of it before the next episode. Hey man, we did it again. We talked about Superman.
Yeah, we did it. We did it again. We done it twice, and we'll do it again.
And I can't wait.
Well,
thanks everybody. I hope we didn't ramble too much for you.
Go watch Man of Steel so you can keep up.
Yeah, we'll see you next time.
All right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Josh, Dan, and Superman, a Trek Nerd podcast. If you like what you've heard and are feeling generous, why not head over to patreon.com/treknerd, that's TrekNurd, and click on the tier for our show. Remember, the more you contribute, the more sexually attractive you will be to the gender of your choice. That's just science, folks. All music for the show is provided by the immensely talented and exceptionally handsome Mr. Patrick Lee. He can be found on Spotify, Apple Music, or visit his website at patricklemusic.org.
Supporting independent artists like Dan, Patrick, and myself will guarantee longer, healthier lives. Again, that's just science. I'm Josh Paddock. We'll see you next time on Josh, Dan, and Superman.
Let me personally congratulate you on your completion of this achievement unit.